This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by someone who's an expert on a very complex topic, that of drug pricing in America. We've got one of the smartest minds on the phone today, AJ Oyakanu, the CEO of Capital RX, and he's going to talk to us about a whole number of things relating to drug pricing and what can be done about it and so forth. AJ, can you take a moment to introduce yourself and improve my pronunciation of your name?
I'm AJ Oyakanu. I think you did just fine. And I'm the CEO of Capital RX. I've had a front row seat to everything I like and dislike about drug pricing in the United States. And I'm happy to be here today.
Well, fantastic. In just 30, 60 seconds, tell me what you like about pharmaceutical pricing in America. What's going right with it?
Well, I think at the highest level, we have the correct, I would say, mechanics. If you think about it, about statistically, 90% of all drugs are generics in the United States that are lower cost alternatives. The system that we have from a patent standpoint, you have a rapidly graduating schedule where once a drug is approved and enters the market, you know, it's not going to have a 99-year patent protection. You know, it might be a period of anywhere from 7 to 12 years, depending upon how long it took in trials. But the point of it is that the drug system is going to drive to lower cost over time. So it doesn't matter if we develop a novel therapy or an expensive drug, it will eventually graduate to a generic. So I like that about our system today at the highest level.
And let me ask you a question. You know, what I didn't understand is that there's such a spread in the pricing of generics. And I know you use the word spread in a different context, but there's such a difference. The same generic for what was a non-generic, it can be very differently priced. Why is that? Why is there such different pricing for generics?
Well, I think you have to, you know, kind of think about when we pay for a prescription, there's, you know, I would say predominantly two classes of payers. There's a cash paying customer and there's a customer that comes under some qualified benefit, be it a government plan or an employer group plan. And if you look at how all contracting works in the United States for employer group programs is that they use what's called as a list price, average wholesale price, AWP, and there's some sort of discount. And the first problem you have is every carrier and PBM has a different definition of brand, generic, specialty, single source, multi-source, DAW handling, and that should be the first clue there's a problem. The problem gets deeper in which pricing, contracting, or guarantees for employers aren't on a claim level basis. They're in aggregate in buckets over the course of the year. So that gets a little bit hazy as well. And then the other problem is directionally, even list price doesn't make sense anymore. So if you have something that's quoting AWP on a generic, like let's use, for example, amoxicillin, here's a drug that's been off patent for 30 plus years. It's still a top 20 dispensed drug for every employer group in the nation. Yet if we look at the list price, it's inflating gently over 15 years, maybe 20%. But if you look at the acquisition cost, the actual price that hospitals and pharmacies are buying the drug, it's been rapidly deflating over the last 10 years. So who benefits in a model where you have inflating list price and deflating, if you will, reimbursement or acquisition cost? It's this spread pricing model that exists for probably 99-ish percent of the transactions in the U.S. And then it's a real problem.
And so let me ask you a question on that. You say, you ask the question, the rhetorical question, who benefits from the spread pricing? When I talk to hospitals and health systems, they will say that it's not really them. Is it the PBMs? Is it the payers? Who benefits from the spread pricing and how?
Yeah, so it's the carriers and the administrators, the middlemen, the pharmacy benefit managers, because, you know, at right around the turn of a century, you know, we saw this movement to a zero cost admin fee that if you look at the original roots of the pharmacy benefit management system, they used to charge a flat per script fee. And then they had a brilliant marketing idea, which is let's tell everybody it's free. Now we know nothing is free. And what they said to the employer groups was like, hey, we're just going to keep a little bit in the middle, but it's free. And when they did that, they basically created a system in which they had uncapped potential, because what's unique in the pharmacy benefit system is contractually the buyers, in this case, the employer groups and their patients, and the sellers, the pharmacies, are prevented from communicating with each other. So when we talk about spread pricing, you have a market maker in the middle, a PBM, and what they do a magnificent job of is keeping everyone in the dark contractually. And think about it. Imagine if you went to sell your home and your real estate broker just showed up and say, hey, here's a check for $500,000. This is what the buyer is offering you.
Well, and this is, of course, and what happens is, for example, a buyer's agent in the real estate context will tell you there is no commission. But we all know that's not true. They're just splitting the commission with the seller's agent. But let me ask you a question. You know, there's two big buckets of cost. There's, from what I understand, there's the excess cost when a generic's not available and somebody has to go to the non-generic or even amongst the generics. And then there's the excess cost for specialty drugs that are still on patent, but, you know, for particularly chronic or rare diseases. Is the big cost problem in American drug pricing one or the other or both?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above, because they're each contributing to higher trend and costs. So in your earlier example of a generic that be it's deemed, and I use the word deemed, limited supply or is quote unquote unavailable, you know, you have to ask your question, who's making that decision on some level? Because, you know, a lot of people don't understand that even though the pharmacies buy the drugs and stock the shelves, the PBMs set the price. And, you know, that really doesn't make sense. You know, if you think about, you know, a large, let's say, grocery store, you know, every other part of the grocery store is setting the price. You go to the last 1,000 square feet and you go to the pharmacy and a third party sets the price for their inventory. And so I think that's part of it, is the confusion around limited supply or the drug isn't available, quote unquote. Also reclassification. Is it a single source, multi-source? What is the generic status? I think the other issue that you touched upon, which is important, is specialty drugs. Now, this is what's feeding the runaway cost of drugs in America, is the proliferation of specialty drugs. And now we're seeing the birth of gene therapy. And when we look at the cost of these drugs, you have to think as pharma thinks, gross to net. The problem is the inefficiency of the net, that pharma is usually quite generous. I'm not going to give them a pass entirely on this, but part of it is the problem is the system itself, in which a market is so inefficient because it's highly opaque and there's market makers in the middle seeking rent, that the full value can't make it down to the patient and plan level. So you have a highly escalating cost due to the proliferation of these specialty drugs, but the value that's being provided to offset some of this cost is too inefficient, and we need to correct that.
Thank you. Let me ask you another question. So you've been in this sort of area, supply chain and pharmaceuticals, for a very long time. What exactly does Capital Rx do? What does your firm do?
Yeah, so we're pharmacy benefit managers. I'd like to say we're the anti-PBM on some level. What I had a front row seat to, as I mentioned before, is I've been in the supply chain, started with pharmaceutical manufacturing, moved over at one point to audit and procurement for pharmacy benefits. And I recognize the only way to fix the problem would to be really to tackle the problem head on by becoming the PBM. And as the administrator, we could go into a new framework. We could change the way drugs are priced. We don't have to hide price, and we could rebuild trust in the supply chain. And this is an overlooked point, because people that are a part of the supply chain have given up, because if they reduce cost willingly, it never makes it to the end plan and patient. So they, without trust, are just going to obviously create a friction point. And I think it's important to remember. So at Capital Rx, as a PBM, what we're able to do is we're able to establish a better way for drug pricing. And instead of focusing our resources on kind of keeping the good times rolling on spread pricing, we're able to refocus all of our assets and resources on improving care and service delivery for the patient and investing in the technology that we're going to need for the next decades to come.
So fascinating. So how did you, who are your customers? And how did you get started with this? Are they employer groups? Are they payers? Who are your customers? Did you self-fund this? Did you take an outside funding? How did you get this started? Sure. What a fascinating business to be in.
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned, I was able to obviously work with my two great co-founders, Joe, my COO, and Ryan, my CTO. And the three of us shared the same mission: change the way drugs are priced and serviced in the United States. And we think by doing this, we can create enduring social change because every American fills a prescription. But what we wanted to do was we wanted to make sure that we always remembered nothing is sacred. We wanted to change the way the whole thing works. So we started out and we self-funded through management, friends and family is how we bootstrapped the company to begin with. And we operated for the first year to test a lot of the hypotheses that we'd come up with. And after the first year, we were able to grow very rapidly. So our customer base are self-insured entities. These are typically 500 employees plus dependents, up to several thousand. So for us, about 50% of our book of business are commercial entities, about 25% are union, and about 25% are municipality or government entities. And what they all share in common is they're self-insured. The average client size, you know, we'll put it around, you know, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 lives, but it could be anywhere from 500 to 50,000. The point of it is that what we wanted to do when we came together was to really test our thoughts in these theories. And then once we saw them proving out, we knew that we could scale the organization. At that point, we went out and sought formal VC funding. So Edison is our partner.
Fascinating. It's a big, big, well-regarded partner. Congratulations. So what is the, you know, there's this very complex situation where there's both an outcry about pharmaceutical pricing, but there's the thrill amongst many of us. We have a relative with an oncology problem. The sort of immunotherapies and gene therapies that you mentioned just weren't even a figment of the imagination 10 years ago, and now a very difficult cancer relative responding well to. So we're thrilled with what's happened in terms of the development of this, and especially drugs, because they're needed, but they're expensive. What's the future of this, and how do you solve for this? Because we all lament the pharmaceutical prices, but we all want these therapies for, you know, dangerous diseases.
Yeah. So if you think about the U.S. healthcare system, a lot of people would argue is that innovation has been funded by the United States, that we don't negotiate as effectively as perhaps partners overseas. But part of this is the profitability from the U.S. healthcare system for pharma compared to other nations has enabled us to spur innovation. You know, and when I look at this, let's kind of step back for a second. That, you know, I get really excited when I hear that, you know, an infant can be cured of a life-changing disease, or someone can see for the first time through gene therapy. And if you trace the history of the pharmaceutical industry, you know, it started with chemical manufacturing. We moved to pharmaceutical products, and then we moved to biologic products. And now this next evolutionary phase that we're seeing unfold in front of us is gene therapy. And, you know, there was a great study done, the Wall Street Journal covered about a few months back, and it showed that, you know, presently gene therapy might be a $30 million a year industry, but within 6 years, it's going to skyrocket to $10 billion. And so we're beginning to see the birth of gene therapy, like what we saw over a decade ago, the birth of biologic. And we saw that industry take off. And so this is what's going to be fueling our cost trend for the next, you know, call it half century. But I have a lot of hope for it at the same time, that as more therapies enter market, more competition will occur, putting prices down, as well as the pharmaceutical manufacturers will perfect the methods in which they develop these drugs, and that will decrease cost as well. But it's a real social challenge.
I mean, they're getting better and better at that because they don't now need to test things on billions of mice. They do a lot of it electronically and through the computer and through technology today to really test solutions. So the acceleration in it is happening at a rapid, rapid pace. But why is it? So a type of immunotherapy for oncology, to get it done here, a couple $100,000 to get it done in Germany, $40,000. Why is that? Why is there that distinction in what you can get some things done for? And, you know, Germany's not a third world country, most sophisticated country in the world, one of them. Why is it that you can get some of these things done for a lot cheaper but very, very advanced stuff in Europe or in Germany compared to here?
Well, I think a lot of it would depend upon the structure of the healthcare system. Is it a single payer system where you're negotiating for access, not just to a company, not just to a market, but to an entire country? And you have to remember, a lot of times the negotiating country, the word no is in their vocabulary. So they may not cover the same types of therapies that some of them now may be allowed, but maybe in the earlier phases, they weren't considered. Or they may be taken off in the future. You don't know necessarily. Where I think in the United States, you know, obviously we provide access to all therapies as long as they're approved by the FDA, obviously. But the point of it is we're trying to provide better care and better access. Now, there's a cost for that. And I feel like this is a difficult notion. And what I want to give an example of is in the past, when you look at risk for a plan, is that if you spend $10 million a year on drug spend as an employer, you know, from an actuarial assessment, you're safe. You don't need any kind of reinsurance or insurance to protect your loss. Because let's just say the most expensive thing you could see is like a hemophilia drug, and it might cost $1 million, but that's only a 10% shift. But with these new drugs, some of them cost $2.5 million, $2 million. And suddenly you could be in risk where you have a 20% shift. And as an employer, that could be material. Now, if you're a small company, let's just say you're 500 lives or 1,000 lives and you're self-insured, having a $2 million hit would be increasing 200 or 300% your drug spend. And that could be catastrophic.
100%. So another question, then we've got to wrap up in a couple minutes. You mentioned that in other countries, the word no exists. And here it seems bifurcated because maybe it doesn't exist for Medicare, but it certainly seems to exist for a payer. Like the payers love to say no. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think what we have in the United States is, I think what you're referring to is a formulary. And most of the PBM industry likes a one-size-fits-all formulary because that's how they control payer access with pharma. That's how they claw back or carve out deeper rebates and discounts. So when someone says no, it's usually because of a prior authorization or step edit, which is part of a formulary, because what the carrier PBM is attempting to do is to drive someone to a specific therapy that's providing a higher rebate. You know, what's interesting is part of our organization, we provide pharmacogenomic testing, about 6 or 7 therapeutic categories. You can tell with fairly good accuracy which drug a patient will respond better to. This is important because you could provide better care. The reason why I bring this up when you think about this example is it's really important when we look at drug pricing in the US, because when we look at one-size-fits-all formulary, the PBMs like it. But if you start to entertain pharmacogenomics and DNA testing, you're talking about precision medicine. And that's where we think the future is headed with gene therapy and these other categories. And so no shouldn't be the basis of some sort of negotiation exercise that's trying to help the bottom line for the middleman. No should be an exercise of the drug isn't a reasonable therapy and it should be denied, or there are other lesser cost alternatives that should be considered, or ultimately, if it is the best decision based upon a genetic test, it should be. And I think that's kind of the difference we're seeing. We're seeing a radical shift with companies like ourselves that are moving in that direction and people that want to kind of keep the old way moving.
Right. And you see more and more of this issue of people trying to find, if they're equally effective, trying to find the more rational version. And then obviously what you're talking about is the genetic testing, the pharmacological testing to really determine, is this the right drug for this person given their genetic makeup? One last question for you and AJ, and this is, how do people learn more about Capital Rx? How do they get to you? How do they hire you or and so forth?
Sure. Yeah, we'd be thrilled to speak to anyone just in general or about their pharmacy benefit plan. You could reach us at www.cap-rx.com or just search for us on any internet browser under Capital Space Rx and we should come right up.
Well, fascinating and just a pleasure to visit with you today. And I learned a ton and I hope our audience does as well. AJ, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed my time.